never so gracious as when receiving her son's friends in her son's house, and the more unexpected they were, the more honour to her admirable housekeeping preparations for comfort. "How is Miss Hale?" she asked.
"About as broken down by this last stroke as she can be."
"I'm sure it is very well for her that she has such a friend as you. I wish I were her only friend, madam. I dare say it sounds very brutal, but here have I been displaced and turned out of my post of comforter and adviser by a fine lady aunt, and there are cousins and what not claiming her in London as if she were a lapdog belonging to them, and she is too weak and miserable to have a will of her own." "She must indeed be weak," said Mrs. Thornton, with an implied meaning which her son understood well. "But where," continued Mrs. Thornton, "have these relations been all this time that Miss Hale has appeared almost friendless, and has certainly had a good deal of anxiety to bear?" But she did not feel interest enough in the answer to her question to wait for it. She left the room to make her household arrangements. "They have been living abroad. They have some kind of claim upon her. I will do them that justice. The aunt brought her up, and she and the cousin have been like sisters. The thing vexing me, you see, is that I wanted to take her for a child of my own, and I am jealous of these people, who don't seem to value the privilege of their right. Now it would be different if Frederick claimed her."
"Frederick?" exclaimed Mr. Thornton. "Who is he? What right—"
He stopped short in his vehement question.
"Frederick?" said Mr. Bell in surprise. "Why, don't you know? He's her brother. Have you not heard?"
"I never heard his name before. Where is he? Who is he?"
"Surely I told you about him when the family first came to Milton, the son who was concerned in that mutiny."
"I never heard of him till this moment. Where does he live?"
"In Spain. He's liable to be arrested the moment he sets foot on English soil, poor fellow. He will grieve at not being able to attend his father's funeral. We must be content with Captain Lennox, for I don't know of any other relation to summon."
"I hope I may be allowed to go."
"Certainly. Thankfully. You're a good fellow, after all, Thornton. Hale liked you. He spoke to me only the other day about you at Oxford. He regretted he had seen so little of you lately. I am obliged to you for wishing to show him respect."
"But about Frederick, does he never come to England?"
"Never."
"He was not over here about the time of Mrs. Hale's death?"
"No. Why, I was here then. I hadn't seen Hale for years and years, and if you remember, I came—" "No, it was some time after that I came. But poor Frederick Hale was not here then. What made you think he was?"
"I saw a young man walking with Miss Hale one day," replied Mr. Thornton, "and I think it was about that time."
"Oh, that would be this young Lennox, the captain's brother. He's a lawyer, and they were in pretty constant correspondence with him. And I remember Mr. Hale told me he thought he would come down. Do you know," said Mr. Bell, wheeling round and shutting one eye, the better to bring the forces of the other to bear with keen scrutiny on Mr. Thornton's face, "but I once fancied you had a little tenderness for Margaret."
No answer, no change of countenance.
"And so did poor Hale. Not at first, and not until I had put it into his head."
"I admired Miss Hale. Everyone must do so. She is a beautiful creature," said Mr. Thornton, driven to bay by Mr. Bell's pertinacious questioning.
"Is that all? You can speak of her in that measured way as simply a beautiful creature? Only something to catch the eye? I did hope you had had nobleness enough in you to make you pay her the homage of the heart, though I believe, in fact I know, she would have rejected you. Still, to have loved her without return would have lifted you higher than all those, be they who they may, that have never known her to love. Beautiful creature, indeed. Do you speak of her as you would of a horse or a dog?"
Mr. Thornton's eyes glowed like red embers.
"Mr. Bell," said he, "before you speak so, you should remember that all men are not as free to express what they feel as you are. Let us talk of something else."
For though his heart leaped up, as at a trumpet call, to every word that Mr. Bell had said, and though he knew that what he had said would henceforward bind the thought of the old Oxford fellow closely up with the most precious things of his heart, yet he would not be forced into any expression of what he felt towards Margaret.
He was no mockingbird of praise, to try, because another extolled what he reverenced and passionately loved, to outdo him in laudation. So he turned to some of the dry matters of business that lay between Mr. Bell and him, as landlord and tenant. "What is that heap of brick and mortar we came against in the yard? Any repairs wanted?"
"No, none, thank you."
"Are you building on your own account? If you are, I'm very much obliged to you."
"I'm building a dining room, for the men, I mean, the hands."
"I thought you were hard to please. If this room wasn't good enough to satisfy you, a bachelor..."
"I've got acquainted with a strange kind of chap, and I put one or two children in whom he is interested to school. So as I happened to be passing near his house one day, I just went there about some trifling payment to be made, and I saw such a miserable black frizzle of a dinner, a greasy cinder of meat, as first set me a-thinking. But it was not till provisions grew so high this winter that I bethought me how, by buying things wholesale and cooking a good quantity of provisions together, much money might be saved and much comfort gained. So I spoke to my friend, or my enemy, the man I told you of, and he found fault with every detail of my plan, and in consequence I laid it aside, both as impracticable and also because if I forced it into operation, I should be interfering with the independence of my men. When suddenly this Higgins came to me and graciously signified his approval of a scheme so nearly the same as mine, but I might barely have claimed it. And, moreover, the approval of several of his fellow workmen to whom he had spoken. I was a little riled, I confess, by his manner, and thought of throwing the whole thing overboard to sink or swim. But it seemed childish to relinquish a plan which I'd once thought wise and well laid, just because I myself did not receive all the honour and consequence due to the originator. So I coolly took the part assigned to me, which is something like that of steward to a club. I buy the provisions wholesale and provide a fitting matron or cook.
I hope you give satisfaction in your new capacity. Are you a good judge of potatoes and onions? But I suppose Mrs. Thornton assists you in your marketing.
Not a bit, replied Mr. Thornton. She disapproves of the whole plan, and now we never mention it to each other. But I manage pretty well, getting in great stocks from Liverpool, and being served in butcher's meat by our own family butcher. I can assure you, the hot dinners the matron turns out are by no means to be despised.
Do you taste each dish as it goes in virtue of your office? I hope you have a white wand.
I was very scrupulous at first in confining myself to the mere purchasing part, and even in that I rather obeyed the men's orders conveyed through the housekeeper, than went by my own judgment. At one time the beef was too large, at another the mutton was not fat enough. I think they saw how careful I was to leave them free and not to intrude my own ideas upon them. So one day, two or three of the men, my friend Higgins among them, asked me if I would not come in and take a snack. It was a very busy day, but I saw that the men would be hurt if, after making the advance, I didn't meet them halfway. So I went in, and I never made a better dinner in my life. I told them, my next neighbours I mean, for I'm no speechmaker, how much I'd enjoyed it, and for some time, whenever that especial dinner recurred in their dietary, I was sure to be met by these men with a master. There's hot pot for dinner today, when you come. If they had not asked me, I would no more have intruded on them than I'd have gone to the mess at the barracks without invitation.
I should think you were rather a restraint on your host's conversation. They can't abuse the masters while you're there. I suspect they take it out on non-hot pot days.
Well, hitherto we've steered clear of all vexed questions, but if any of the old disputes came up again, I would certainly speak out my mind next hot-pot day. But you are hardly acquainted with our Darkshire fellows, for all you're a Darkshire man yourself. They have such a sense of humour and such a racy mode of expression. I am getting really to know some of them now, and they talk pretty freely before me.
Nothing like the act of eating for equalising men. Dying is nothing to it. The philosopher dies sententiously, the Pharisee ostentatiously, the simple-hearted humbly, the poor idiot blindly, as the sparrow falls to the ground. The philosopher and idiot, publican and Pharisee, all eat after the same fashion, given an equally good digestion. There's theory for theory for you.
Indeed, I have no theory. I hate theories.
I beg your pardon. To show my penitence, will you accept a £10 note towards your marketing and give the poor fellows a feast?
Thank you, but I'd rather not. They pay me rent for the oven and cooking places at the back of the mill, and will have to pay more for the new dining room. I don't want it to fall into a charity. I don't want donations. Once let in the principal, and I should have people going and talking and spoiling the simplicity of the whole thing.
People will talk about any new plan. You can't help that.
My enemies, if I have any, may make a philanthropic fuss about this dinner scheme. But you are a friend, and I expect you will pay my experiment the respect of silence. It is but a new broom at present, and sweeps clean enough. But by and by we shall meet with plenty of stumbling blocks, no doubt.
Chapter 43 Margaret's Flitten. The meanest thing to which we bid adieu loses its meanness in the parting hour. Elliot. Mrs. Shaw took as vehement a dislike as was possible for one of her gentle nature to do against Milton. It was noisy and smoky, and the poor people whom she saw in the streets were dirty, and the rich ladies overdressed, and not a man that she saw, high or low, had his clothes made to fit him. She was sure Margaret would never regain her lost strength while she stayed in Milton, and she herself was afraid of one of her old attacks of the nerves. Margaret must return with her, and that quickly. This, if not the exact force of her words, was at any rate the spirit of what she urged on Margaret, till the latter, weak, weary, and broken-spirited, yielded a reluctant promise that as soon as Wednesday was over, she would prepare to accompany her aunt back to town, leaving Dixon in charge of all the arrangements for paying bills, disposing of furniture, and shutting up the house. Before that Wednesday, that mournful Wednesday when Mr. Hale was to be interred, far away from either of the homes he had known in life, and far away from the wife who lay lonely among strangers, and this last was Margaret's great trouble, for she thought that if she had not given way to that overwhelming stupor during the first sad days, she could have arranged things otherwise. Before that Wednesday, Margaret received a letter from Mr. Bell.
"My dear Margaret, I did mean to have returned to Milton on Thursday, but unluckily it turns out to be one of the rare occasions when we Plymouth fellows are called upon to perform any kind of duty, and I must not be absent from my post. Captain Lennox and Mr. Thornton are here. The former seems a smart, well-meaning man, and has proposed to go over to Milton and assist you in any search for the will. Of course there is none, or you would have found it by this time, if you followed my directions. Then the captain declares he must take you and his mother-in-law home, and in his wife's present state, I don't see how you can expect him to remain away longer than Friday. However, that Dixon of yours is trusty, and can hold her, or your own, until I come. I will put matters into the hands of my Milton attorney, if there is no will, for I doubt this smart captain is no great man of business. Nevertheless, his mustachios are splendid. There will have to be a sale, so select what things you wish reserved, or you can send a list afterwards. Now, two things more, and I have done. You know, or if you don't, your poor father did, that you are to have my money and goods when I die. Not that I mean to die yet, but I name this just to explain what is coming. These Lennoxes seem very fond of you now, and perhaps may continue to be, perhaps not. So it is best to start with a formal agreement, namely, that you are to pay them £250 a year, as long as you and they find it pleasant to live together. This, of course, includes Dixon. Mind you don't be cajoled into paying any more for her. Then you won't be thrown adrift, if some day the captain wishes to have his house to himself, but you can carry yourself and your £250 off somewhere else. If indeed I have not claimed you to come and keep house for me first. Then as to dress, and Dixon, and personal expenses, and confectionery, all young ladies eat confectionery till wisdom comes by age, I shall consult some lady of my acquaintance, and see how much you will have from your father before fixing this. Now, Margaret,
Have you flown out before you have read this far, and wondered what right the old man has to settle your affairs for you so cavalierly?
I make no doubt you have.
Yet the old man has a right. He has loved your father for 35 years. He stood beside him on his wedding day. He closed his eyes in death. Moreover, he is your godfather, and as he cannot do you much good spiritually, having a hidden consciousness of your superiority in such things, he would fain do you the poor good of endowing you materially. And the old man has not a known relation on earth. Who is there to mourn for Adam Bell? And his whole heart is set and bent upon this one thing, and Margaret Hale is not the girl to say him nay. Write by return, if only 2 lines, to tell me your answer. But no thanks.
Margaret took up a pen and scrawled with trembling hand, Margaret Hale is not the girl to say him nay. In her weak state, she could not think of any other words, and yet she was vexed to use these. But she was so much fatigued even by this slight exertion, that if she could have thought of another form of acceptance, she could not have sate up to write a syllable of it. She was obliged to lie down again and try not to think.
My dearest child, has that letter vexed or troubled you?
No, said Margaret feebly. I shall be better when tomorrow is over.
I feel sure, darling, you won't be better till I get you out of this horrid air. How you can have borne it these 2 years, I can't imagine.
Where could I go to? I could not leave Papa and Mama.
Well, don't distress yourself, my dear. I dare say it was all for the best, only I had no conception of how you were living. Our butler's wife lives in a better house than this.
It is sometimes very pretty, in summer. You can't judge by what it is now. I have been very happy here.
And Margaret closed her eyes by way of stopping the conversation. The house teemed with comfort now, compared to what it had done. The evenings were chilly, and by Mrs. Shaw's directions, fires were lighted in every bedroom. She petted Margaret in every possible way, and bought every delicacy or soft luxury in which she herself would have burrowed and sought comfort. But Margaret was indifferent to all these things, or if they forced themselves upon her attention, it was simply as causes for gratitude to her aunt, who was putting herself so much out of her way to think of her. She was restless, though so weak. All the day long, she kept herself from thinking of the ceremony which was going on at Oxford by wandering from room to room and languidly setting aside such articles as she wished to retain. Dixon followed her by Mrs. Shaw's desire, ostensibly to receive instructions, but with a private injunction to soothe her into repose as soon as might be.
"These books, Dixon, I will keep. All the rest will you send to Mr. Bell. They are of a kind that he will value for themselves, as well as for Papa's sake. This, I should like you to take this to Mr. Thornton after I am gone. Stay, I will write a note with it."
And she sate down hastily, as if afraid of thinking, and wrote,
Dear Sir, the accompanying book I am sure will be valued by you for the sake of my father, to whom it belonged. Yours sincerely, Margaret Hale.
She set out again upon her travels through the house, turning over articles known to her from her childhood, with a sort of caressing reluctance to leave them, old-fashioned, worn and shabby as they might be. But she hardly spoke again, and Dixon's report to Mrs. Shaw was that she doubted whether Miss Hale heard a word of what she said, though she talked the whole time, in order to divert her attention. The consequence of being on her feet all day was excessive bodily weariness in the evening, and a better night's rest than she had had since she had heard of Mr. Hale's death. At breakfast time the next day, she expressed her wish to go and bid one or two friends good-bye. Mrs. Shaw objected.
I am sure, my dear, you can have no friends here with whom you are sufficiently intimate to justify you in calling upon them so soon, before you have been at church.
But today is my only day. If Captain Lennox comes this afternoon, and if I must really go tomorrow...
Oh, yes, we shall go tomorrow.
I am more and more convinced that this air is bad for you and makes you look so pale and ill. Besides, Edith expects us, and she may be waiting me. And you cannot be left alone, my dear, at your age. No, if you must pay these calls, I will go with you. Dixon can get us a coach, I suppose. So Mrs. Shaw went to take care of Margaret and took her maid with her to take care of the shawls and air cushions. Margaret's face was too sad to lighten up into a smile at all this preparation for paying two visits that she had often made by herself at all hours of the day. She was half afraid of owning that one place to which she was going was Nicholas Higgins's. All she could do was to hope her aunt would be indisposed to get out of the coach and walk up the court, and at every breath of wind have her face slapped by wet clothes hanging out to dry on ropes stretched from house to house. There was a little battle in Mrs. Shaw's mind between ease and a sense of matronly propriety, but the former gained the day, and with many an injunction to Margaret to be careful of herself and not to catch any fever, such as was always lurking in such places, her aunt permitted her to go where she had often been before, without taking any precaution or requiring any permission. Nicholas was out, Mary and one or two of the Boucher children at home. Margaret was vexed with herself for not having timed her visit better. Mary had a very blunt intellect, although her feelings were warm and kind, and the instant she understood what Margaret's purpose was in coming to see them, she began to cry and sob with so little restraint that Margaret found it useless to say any of the thousand little things which had suggested themselves to her as she was coming along in the coach. She could only try to comfort her a little by suggesting the vague chance of their meeting again, at some possible time, in some possible place, and bid her tell her father how much she wished, if he could manage it, that he should come to see her when he had done his work in the evening. As she was leaving the place, she stopped and looked round, then hesitated a little before she said, "I should like to have some little thing to remind me of Bessie." Instantly, Mary's generosity was keenly alive. What could they give? And on Margaret singling out a little common drinking cup, which she remembered as the one always standing by Bessie's side, with drink for her feverish lips, Mary said, "Oh, take somewhat better. That only cost fourpence." "That will do, thank you," said Margaret, and she went quickly away, while the light caused the pleasure of having something to give, yet lingered on Mary's face. "Now to Mrs. Thornton's," thought she to herself. "It must be done." But she looked rather rigid and pale at the thought of it, and had hard work to find the exact words in which to explain to her aunt who Mrs. Thornton was, and why she should go to bid her farewell. They, for Mrs. Shaw alighted here, were shown into the drawing-room, in which a fire had only just been kindled. Mrs. Shaw huddled herself up in her shawl and shivered. "What an icy room," she said. They had to wait for some time before Mrs. Thornton entered. There was some softening in her heart towards Margaret, now that she was going away out of her sight. She remembered her spirit, as shown at various times and places, even more than the patience with which she had endured long and wearing cares. Her countenance was blander than usual as she greeted her. There was even a shade of tenderness in her manner, as she noticed the white, tear-swollen face and the quiver in the voice which Margaret tried to make so steady. "Allow me to introduce my aunt, Mrs. Shaw. I am going away from Milton tomorrow. I do not know if you are aware of it, but I wanted to see you once again, Mrs. Thornton, to apologize for my manner the last time I saw you, and to say that I am sure you meant kindly, however much we may have misunderstood each other." Mrs. Shaw looked extremely perplexed by what Margaret had said. "Thanks for kindness, and apologies for failure in good manners." But Mrs. Thornton replied, "Miss Hale, I am glad you do me justice. I did no more than I believed to be my duty in remonstrating with you as I did. I have always desired to act the part of a friend to you. I am glad you do me justice." "And," said Margaret, blushing excessively as she spoke, "will you do me justice, and believe that though I cannot, I do not choose to give explanations of my conduct, I have not acted in the unbecoming way you apprehended?"
Margaret's voice was so soft and her eyes so pleading that Mrs. Thornton was for once affected by the charm of manner to which she had hitherto proved herself invulnerable.
"Yes, I do believe you. Let us say no more about it. Where are you going to reside, Miss Hale? I understood from Mr. Bell that you were going to leave Milton. You never liked Milton, you know," said Mrs. Thornton with a sort of grim smile. "But for all that, you must not expect me to congratulate you on quitting it. Where shall you live?"
"With my aunt," replied Margaret, turning towards Mrs. Shaw. "My niece will reside with me in Harley Street. She is almost like a daughter to me," said Mrs. Shaw, looking fondly at Margaret, "and I am glad to acknowledge my own obligation for any kindness that has been shown to her. If you and your husband ever come to town, my son and daughter, Captain and Mrs. Lennox, will, I am sure, join with me in wishing to do anything in our power to show you attention."
Mrs. Thornton thought in her own mind that Margaret had not taken much care to enlighten her aunt as to the relationship between the Mr. and Mrs. Thornton, towards whom the fine lady aunt was extending her soft patronage. So she answered shortly, "My husband is dead. Mr. Thornton is my son. I never go to London, so I am not likely to be able to avail myself of your polite offers." At this instant, Mr. Thornton entered the room. He had only just returned from Oxford. His morning suit spoke of the reason that had called him there. "John," said his mother, "this lady is Mrs. Shaw, Miss Hale's aunt. I am sorry to say that Miss Hale's call is to wish us good-bye."
"You are going, then?"
said he in a low voice.
"Yes," said Margaret, "we leave tomorrow."
"My son-in-law comes this evening to escort us," said Mrs. Shaw.
Mr. Thornton turned away. He had not sat down, and now he seemed to be examining something on the table, almost as if he had discovered an unopened letter, which had made him forget the present company. He did not even seem to be aware when they got up to take leave. He started forwards, however, to hand Mrs. Shaw down to the carriage. As it drove up, he and Margaret stood close together on the doorstep, and it was impossible but that the recollection of the day of the riot should force itself into both their minds. Into his it came associated with the speeches of the following day. Her passionate declaration that there was not a man in all that violent and desperate crowd for whom she did not care as much as for him. And at the remembrance of her taunting words, his brow grew stern, though his heart beat thick with longing love. "No," said he, "I put it to the touch once, and I lost it all. Let her go, with her stony heart and her beauty. How set and terrible her look is now, for all her loveliness of feature. She is afraid I shall speak what will require some stern repression. Let her go. Beauty and heiress as she may be, she will find it hard to meet with a truer heart than mine. Let her go." And there was no tone of regret or emotion of any kind in the voice with which he said goodbye. And the offered hand was taken with a resolute calmness, and dropped as carelessly as if it had been a dead and withered flower. But none in his household saw Mr. Thornton again that day. He was busily engaged, or so he said. Margaret's strength was so utterly exhausted by these visits that she had to submit to much watching and petting and sighing I-told-you-sos from her aunt. Dixon said she was quite as bad as she had been on the first day she heard of her father's death, and she and Mrs. Shaw consulted as to the desirableness of delaying the morrow's journey. But when her aunt reluctantly proposed a few days' delay to Margaret, the latter writhed her body as if in acute suffering and said, "Oh, let us go. I cannot be patient here. I shall not get well here. I want to forget." So the arrangements went on, and Captain Lennox came, and with him news of Edith and the little boy, and Margaret found that the indifferent, careless conversation of one who, however kind, was not too warm and anxious a sympathizer, did her good. She roused up, and by the time that she knew she might expect Higgins, she was able to leave the room quietly and await in her own chamber the expected summons. "Said he as she came in, "to think of the old gentleman dropping off as he did. You might ha' knocked me down wi' a straw when they telled me. 'Mr. Hale,' said I,
him as was the parson? Aye, said they. Then, said I, there's as good a man gone as ever lived on this earth. Let who will be t'other. And I came to see you, and tell you how grieved I were. But them women in the kitchen wouldn't tell you I was there. They said you were ill, and butter me, but you dunnot look like the same wench. And you're going to be a grand lady up in London, aren't you?
Not a grand lady, said Margaret Harp, smiling.
Well, Thornton said, says he a day or two ago, Higgins, have you seen Miss Hale? No, says I, there's a pack of women who won't let me at her. But I can bide my time if she's ill. She and I knows each other pretty well, and who'll not go doubting that I'm main sorry for the old gentleman's death just because I can't get at her and tell her so. And, says he, you'll not have much time for to try and see her, my fine chap. She's not for staying with us a day longer nor she can help. She's got grand relations, and they're carrying her off, and we shan't see her no more. Master, said I, if I do not see her afore who goes, I'll strive to get up to London next Whissantide, that I will. I'll not be balked by saying a goodbye by any relations whatsomdever. But bless you, I knowed you'd come. It were only for to humour the master, I let on as if I thought you'd map and leave Milton without seeing me.
You're quite right, said Margaret. You only do me justice, and you'll not forget me, I'm sure. If no one else in Milton remembers me, I'm certain you will, and Papa, too. You know how good and how tender he was. Look, Higgins, here is his Bible. I have kept it for you. I can ill spare it, but I know he would have liked you to have it. I'm sure you'll care for it and study what is in it for his sake.
You may say that. If it were the deuce's own scribble, and you asked me to read in it for your sake and the old gentleman's, I'd do it.
What's this, wench? I'm not going for to take your brass, so do not think it. We've been great friends about the sound of money passing between us.
For the children, for Boucher's children, said Margaret hurriedly, they may need it. You've no right to refuse it for them. I would not give you a penny, she said, smiling. Don't think there's any of it for you.
Well, wench, I cannot but say bless you, and bless you, and amen.
Chapter 44 Ease, not peace. A dull rotation, never at a stay, yesterday's face to an image of today. Cooper. Of what each one should be, he sees the form and rule, until he reach to that, his joy can ne'er be full. Ruckert. It was very well for Margaret that the extreme quiet of the Harley Street house during Edith's recovery from her confinement gave her the natural rest which she needed. It gave her time to comprehend the sudden change which had taken place in her circumstances within the last 2 months. She found herself at once an inmate of a luxurious house, where the bare knowledge of the existence of every trouble or care seemed scarcely to have penetrated. The wheels of the machinery of daily life were well oiled and went along with delicious smoothness. Mrs. Shaw and Edith could hardly make enough of Margaret on her return to what they persisted in calling her home, and she felt that it was almost ungrateful in her to have a secret feeling that the Helston Vicarage, nay, even the poor little house at Milton, with her anxious father and her invalid mother, and all the small household cares of comparative poverty, composed her idea of home. Edith was impatient to get well, in order to fill Margaret's bedroom with all the soft comforts and pretty knick-knacks with which her own abounded. Mrs. Shaw and her maid found plenty of occupation in restoring Margaret's wardrobe to a state of elegant variety. Captain Lennox was easy, kind, and gentlemanly. Sate with his wife in her dressing-room an hour or two every day, played with his little boy for another hour, and lounged away the rest of his time at his club, when he was not engaged out to dinner. Just before Margaret had recovered from her necessity for quiet and repose, before she had begun to feel her life wanting and dull, Edith came downstairs and resumed her usual part in the household, and Margaret fell into the old habit of watching and admiring and ministering to her cousin. She gladly took all charge of the semblances of duties off Edith's hands. answered notes, reminded her of engagements, tended her when no gaiety was in prospect, and she was consequently rather inclined to fancy herself ill. But all the rest of the family were in the full business of the London season, and Margaret was often left alone. Then her thoughts went back to Milton, with a strange sense of the contrast between the life there and here. She was getting surfeited of the eventless ease in which no struggle or endeavour was required. She was afraid lest she should even become sleepily deadened into forgetfulness of anything beyond a life which was lapping her round with luxury. There might be toilers and moilers there in London, but she never saw them. The very servants lived in an underground world of their own, of which she knew neither the hopes nor the fears. They only seemed to start into existence when some want or whim of their master and mistress needed them. There was a strange unsatisfied vacuum in Margaret's heart and mode of life. And, once when she had dimly hinted this to Edith, the latter, wearied with dancing the night before, languidly stroked Margaret's cheek as she sat by her in the old attitude, she on a footstool by the sofa where Edith lay.
"Poor child," said Edith, "it is a little sad for you to be left, night after night, just at this time when all the world is so gay. But we shall be having our dinner party soon as Henry comes back from circuit, and then there will be a little pleasant variety for you. No wonder it is moped, poor darling."
Margaret did not feel as if the dinner parties would be a panacea, but Edith piqued herself on her dinner parties. "So different," as she said, "from the old dowager dinners under Mama's regime." And Mrs. Shaw herself seemed to take exactly the same kind of pleasure in the very different arrangements and circle of acquaintances which were to Captain and Mrs. Lennox's taste, as she did in the more formal and ponderous entertainments which she herself used to give. Captain Lennox was always extremely kind and brotherly to Margaret. She was really very fond of him, excepting when he was anxiously attentive to Edith's dress and appearance, with a view to her beauty making a sufficient impression on the world. Then all the latent Vashti in Margaret was roused, and she could hardly keep herself from expressing her feelings. The course of Margaret's day was this: a quiet hour or two before a late breakfast, an unpunctual meal lazily eaten by weary and half-awake people, but yet at which, in all its dragged-out length, she was expected to be present, because directly afterwards came a discussion of plans, at which, although they none of them concerned her, she was expected to give her sympathy, if she could not assist with her advice. An endless number of notes to write, which Edith invariably left to her, with many caressing compliments as to her eloquence du billet. A little play with Sholto as he returned from his morning's walk, besides the care of the children during the servants' dinner, a drive or callers, and some dinner or morning engagement for her aunt and cousins, which left Margaret free, it is true, but rather wearied with the inactivity of the day, coming upon depressed spirits and delicate health. She looked forward with longing, though unspoken interest, to the homely object of Dixon's return from Milton, where, until now, the old servant had been busily engaged in winding up all the affairs of the Hale family. It had appeared a sudden famine to her heart, this entire cessation of any news respecting the people amongst whom she had lived so long. It was true that Dixon, in her business letters, quoted every now and then an opinion of Mr. Thornton's as to what she had better do about the furniture, or how act in regard to the landlord of the Crampton Terrace house. But it was only here and there that the name came in, or any Milton name indeed, and Margaret was sitting one evening all alone in the Lennox's drawing-room, not reading Dixon's letters, which yet she held in her hand, but thinking over them, and recalling the days which had been, and picturing the busy life out of which her own had been taken and never missed, wondering if all went on in that world just as if she and her father had never been, questioning within herself if no one in all the crowd missed her. Not Higgins, she was not thinking of him, when suddenly Mr. Bell was announced, and Margaret hurried the letters into her work-basket and started up, blushing as if she had been doing some guilty thing.
"Oh, Mr. Bell, I never thought of seeing you."
But you'll give me a welcome, I hope, as well as that very pretty start of surprise.
Have you dined? How did you come? Let me order you some dinner.
If you're going to have any. Otherwise, you know, there is no one who cares less for eating than I do. But where are the others? Gone out to dinner? Left you alone?
Oh, yes, and it is such a rest. I was just thinking. But will you run the risk of dinner? I don't know if there is anything in the house.
Why, to tell you the truth, I dined at my club. Only they don't cook as well as they did, so I thought if you were going to dine, I might try and make out my dinner. But never mind, never mind. There aren't 10 cooks in England to be trusted at impromptu dinners. If their skill and their fires will stand it, their tempers won't. You shall make me some tea, Margaret. And now, what were you thinking of? You were going to tell me. Whose letters were those, goddaughter, that you hid away so speedily?
Only Dixon's, replied Margaret, growing very red.
Phew, is that all? Who do you think came up in the train with me?
I don't know, said Margaret, resolved against making a guess.
You're what do you call him?
What's the right name for a cousin-in-law's brother?
Mr. Henry Lennox, asked Margaret.
Yes, replied Mr. Bell. You knew him formerly, didn't you? What sort of a person is he, Margaret?
I liked him long ago, said Margaret, glancing down for a moment. And then she looked straight up and went on in her natural manner. You know we have been corresponding about Frederick since, but I have not seen him for nearly 3 years, and he may be changed. What did you think of him?
I don't know. He was so busy trying to find out who I was in the first instance and what I was in the second that he never let out what he was. Unless, indeed, that veiled curiosity of his as to what manner of man he had to talk to was not a good piece and a fair indication of his character.
Do you call him good-looking, Margaret?
No, certainly not.
Do you?
Not I, but I thought perhaps you might. Is he a great deal here?
I fancy he is when he is in town. He has been on circuit now since I came. But, Mr. Bell, have you come from Oxford or from Milton?
From Milton? Don't you see I'm smoke-dried?
Certainly, but I thought that it might be the effect of the antiquities of Oxford.
Come now, be a sensible woman. In Oxford I could have managed all the landlords in the place and had my own way, with half the trouble your Milton landlord has given me, and defeated me after all. He won't take the house off our hands till next June 12th. Luckily, Mr. Thornton found a tenant for it. Why don't you ask after Mr. Thornton, Margaret? He has proved himself a very active friend of yours, I can tell you. Taken more than half the trouble off my hands.
And how is he? How is Mrs. Thornton?
Asked Margaret hurriedly and below her breath, though she tried to speak out.
I suppose they're well. I've been staying at their house till I was driven out of it by the perpetual clack about that Thornton girl's marriage. It was too much for Thornton himself, though she was his sister. He used to go and sit in his own room perpetually. He's getting past the age for caring for such things, either as principal or accessory. I was surprised to find the old lady falling into the current and carried away by her daughter's enthusiasm for orange blossoms and lace. I thought Mrs. Thornton had been made of sterner stuff.
She would put on any assumption of feeling to veil her daughter's weakness, said Margaret in a low voice.
Perhaps so. You've studied her, have you? She doesn't seem over fond of you, Margaret.
I know it, said Margaret.
Oh, here is tea at last, exclaimed she, as if relieved. And with tea came Mr. Henry Lennox, who had walked up to Harley Street after a late dinner and had evidently expected to find his brother and sister-in-law at home. Margaret suspected him of being as thankful as she was at the presence of a third party, on this their first meeting since the memorable day of his offer and her refusal at Helston. She could hardly tell what to say at first, and was thankful for all the tea-table occupations, which gave her an excuse for keeping silence, and him an opportunity of recovering himself. For, to tell the truth, he had rather forced himself up to Harley Street this evening, with a view of getting over an awkward meeting, awkward even in the presence of Captain Lennox and Edith, and doubly awkward now that he found her the only lady there, and the person to whom he must naturally and perforce address a great part of his conversation.
She was the first to recover her self-possession. She began to talk on the subject which came uppermost in her mind after the first flush of awkward shyness. "Mr. Lennox, I have been so much obliged to you for all you have done about Frederick."
"I am only sorry it has been so unsuccessful," replied he, with a quick glance towards Mr. Bell, as if reconnoitring how much he might say before him.
Margaret, as if she read his thought, addressed herself to Mr. Bell, both including him in the conversation and implying that he was perfectly aware of the endeavours that had been made to clear Frederick.
"That Horrocks, that very last witness of all, has proved as unavailing as all the others. Mr. Lennox has discovered that he sailed for Australia only last August, only 2 months before Frederick was in England, and gave us the names of..."
"Frederick in England? You never told me that," exclaimed Mr. Bell in surprise.
"I thought you knew. I never doubted you had been told. Of course it was a great secret, and perhaps I should not have named it now," said Margaret a little dismayed.
"I have never named it to either my brother or your cousin," said Mr. Lennox, with a little professional dryness of implied reproach.
"Never mind, Margaret. I am not living in a talking, bubbling world, nor yet among people who are trying to worm facts out of me. You needn't look so frightened because you have let the cat out of the bag to a faithful old hermit like me. I shall never name his having been in England. I shall be out of temptation, for no one will ask me. Stay," interrupting himself rather abruptly, "was it at your mother's funeral?"
"He was with Mama when she died," said Margaret softly.
"To be sure, to be sure. Why, someone asked me if he had not been over then, and I denied it stoutly, not many weeks ago. Who could it have been? Oh, I recollect."
But he did not say the name, and although Margaret would have given much to know if her suspicions were right, and it had been Mr. Thornton who had made the inquiry, she could not ask the question of Mr. Bell, much as she longed to do so. There was a pause for a moment or two. Then Mr. Lennox said, addressing himself to Margaret,
"I suppose as Mr. Bell is now acquainted with all the circumstances attending your brother's unfortunate dilemma, I cannot do better than inform him exactly how the research into the evidence we once hoped to produce in his favour stands at present. So if he will do me the honour to breakfast with me tomorrow, we will go over the names of these missing gentry."
"I should like to hear all the particulars, if I may. Cannot you come here? I dare not ask you both to breakfast, though I am sure you would be welcome. But let me know all I can about Frederick, even though there may be no hope at present."
"I have an engagement at 11:30, but I will certainly come if you wish it," replied Mr. Lennox, with a little afterthought of extreme willingness, which made Margaret shrink into herself and almost wish that she had not proposed her natural request.
Mr. Bell got up and looked around him for his hat, which had been removed to make room for tea.
"Well," said he, "I don't know what Mr. Lennox is inclined to do, but I'm disposed to be moving off homewards. I've been a journey today, and journeys begin to tell upon my 60-and-odd years."
"I believe I shall stay and see my brother and sister," said Mr. Lennox, making no movement of departure. Margaret was seized with a shy, awkward dread of being left alone with him. The scene on the little terrace in Helston Garden was so present to her that she could hardly help believing it was so with him.
"Don't go yet, please, Mr. Bell," said she hastily. "I want you to see Edith, and I want Edith to know you. Please," said she, laying a light but determined hand on his arm.
He looked at her and saw the confusion stirring in her countenance. He sat down again, as if her little touch had been possessed of resistless strength.
"You see how she overpowers me, Mr. Lennox," said he, "and I hope you noticed the happy choice of her expressions. She wants me to see this cousin Edith, who I am told is a great beauty. But she has the honesty to change her word when she comes to me. Mrs. Lennox is to know me. I suppose I am not much to see, eh, Margaret?"
He joked to give her time to recover from the slight flutter which he had detected in her manner on his proposal to leave, and she caught the tone and threw the ball back. Mr. Lennox wondered how his brother, the captain, could have reported her as having lost all her good looks. To be sure, in her quiet black dress, she was a contrast to Edith, dancing in her white crepe mourning and long floating golden hair, all softness and glitter. She dimpled and blushed most becomingly when introduced to Mr. Bell, conscious that she had her reputation as a beauty to keep up, and that it would not do to have a Mordecai refusing to worship and admire, even in the shape of an old fellow of a college which nobody had ever heard of. Mrs. Shaw and Captain Lennox, each in their separate way, gave Mr. Bell a kind and sincere welcome, winning him over to like them almost in spite of himself, especially when he saw how naturally Margaret took her place as sister and daughter of the house.
"What a shame that we were not at home to receive you," said Edith. "You too, Henry, though I don't know that we should have stayed at home for you, and for Mr. Bell, for Margaret's Mr. Bell."
"There is no knowing what sacrifices you would not have made," said her brother-in-law, "even a dinner party, and the delight of wearing this very becoming dress." Edith did not know whether to frown or to smile, but it did not suit Mr. Lennox to drive her to the first of these alternatives, so he went on. "Will you show your readiness to make sacrifices tomorrow morning, first by asking me to breakfast to meet Mr. Bell, and secondly, by being so kind as to order it at 9:30 instead of 10 o'clock. I have some letters and papers that I want to show to Miss Hale and Mr. Bell."
"I hope Mr. Bell will make our house his own during his stay in London," said Captain Lennox. "I am only so sorry we cannot offer him a bedroom."
"Thank you. I am much obliged to you. You would only think me a churl if you had, for I should decline it, I believe, in spite of all the temptations of such agreeable company," said Mr. Bell, bowing all round and secretly congratulating himself on the neat turn he had given to his sentence, which, if put into plain language, would have been more to this effect: "I couldn't stand the restraints of such a proper-behaved and civil-spoken set of people as these are. It would be like meat without salt. I'm thankful they haven't a bed. And how well I rounded my sentence. I'm absolutely catching the trick of good manners."
His self-satisfaction lasted him till he was fairly out in the streets, walking side by side with Henry Lennox. Here he suddenly remembered Margaret's little look of entreaty as she urged him to stay longer, and he also recollected a few hints given him long ago by an acquaintance of Mr. Lennox's as to his admiration of Margaret. It gave a new direction to his thoughts.
"You have known Miss Hale for a long time, I believe. How do you think her looking? She strikes me as pale and ill."
"I thought her looking remarkably well. Perhaps not when I first came in, now I think of it. But certainly when she grew animated, she looked as well as ever I saw her do."
"She has had a great deal to go through," said Mr. Bell.
"Yes, I have been sorry to hear of all she has had to bear, not merely the common and universal sorrow arising from death, but all the annoyance which her father's conduct must have caused her, and then..."
"Her father's conduct?" said Mr. Bell, in an accent of surprise. "You must have heard some wrong statement. He behaved in the most conscientious manner. He showed more resolute strength than I should ever have given him credit for formerly."
"Perhaps I have been wrongly informed, but I have been told by his successor in the living, a clever, sensible man and a thoroughly active clergyman, that there was no call upon Mr. Hale to do what he did, relinquish the living and throw himself and his family on the tender mercies of private teaching in a manufacturing town. The bishop had offered him another living, it is true, but if he had come to entertain certain doubts, he could have remained where he was, and so had no occasion to resign. But the truth is, these country clergymen live such isolated lives, isolated, I mean, from all intercourse with men of equal cultivation with themselves, by whose minds they might regulate their own, and discover when they were going either too fast or too slow, that they are very apt to disturb themselves with imaginary doubts as to the articles of faith, and throw up certain opportunities of doing good for very uncertain fancies of their own."
"I differ from you. I do not think they are very apt to do as my poor friend Hale did."
Mr. Bell was inwardly chafing.
"Perhaps I used too general an expression in saying very apt, but certainly their lives are such as very often to produce either inordinate self-sufficiency or a morbid state of conscience," replied Mr. Lennox with perfect coolness.
"You don't meet with any self-sufficiency among the lawyers, for instance?"
asked Mr. Bell.
"And seldom I imagine any cases of morbid conscience."
He was becoming more and more vexed and forgetting his lately caught trick of good manners. Mr. Lennox saw now that he had annoyed his companion, and as he talked pretty much for the sake of saying something, and so passing the time while their road lay together, he was very indifferent as to the exact side he took upon the question, and quietly came round by saying, "To be sure there is something fine in a man of Mr. Hale's age, leaving his home of 20 years, and giving up all settled habits, for an idea which was probably erroneous, but that does not matter, an intangible thought. One cannot help admiring him, with a mixture of pity in one's admiration, something like what one feels for Don Quixote. Such a gentleman as he was, too. I shall never forget the refined and simple hospitality he showed to me that last day at Helston." Only half mollified and yet anxious, in order to lull certain qualms of his own conscience, to believe that Mr. Hale's conduct had a tinge of quixotism in it, Mr. Bell growled out,
"Aye, and you don't know Milton. Such a change from Helston. It is years since I have been at Helston, but I'll answer for it, it is standing there yet, every stick and every stone as it has done for the last century, while Milton, I go there every 4 or 5 years, and I was born there, yet I do assure you, I often lose my way, I among the very piles of warehouses that are built upon my father's orchard. Do we part here? Well, good night, sir. I suppose we shall meet in Harley Street tomorrow morning."
Chapter 45. Not All a Dream. Where are the sounds that swam along the buoyant air when I was young? The last vibration now is o'er, and they who listened are no more. Ah, let me close my eyes and dream. W.S. Landor. The idea of Helston had been suggested to Mr. Bell's waking mind by his conversation with Mr. Lennox, and all night long it ran riot through his dreams. He was again the tutor in the college where he now held the rank of fellow. It was again a long vacation, and he was staying with his newly married friend, the proud husband and happy vicar of Helston. Over babbling brooks they took impossible leaps, which seemed to keep them whole days suspended in the air. Time and space were not, though all other things seemed real. Every event was measured by the emotions of the mind, not by its actual existence. For existence it had none, but the trees were gorgeous in their autumnal leafiness. The warm odours of flower and herb came sweet upon the sense. The young wife moved about her house with just the mixture of annoyance at her position as regarded wealth, with pride in her handsome and devoted husband, which Mr. Bell had noticed in real life a quarter of a century ago. The dream was so like life that when he awoke, his present life seemed like a dream. Where was he? In the close, handsomely furnished room of a London hotel. Where were those who spoke to him, moved around him, touched him not an instant ago? Dead, buried, lost forevermore, as far as earth's forevermore would extend. He was an old man, so lately exultant in the full strength of manhood. The utter loneliness of his life was insupportable to think about. He got up hastily and tried to forget what nevermore might be in a hurried dressing for the breakfast in Harley Street. He could not attend to all the lawyer's details, which, as he saw, made Margaret's eyes dilate and her lips grow pale, as one by one fate decreed, or so it seemed, every morsel of evidence which would exonerate Frederick should fall from beneath her feet and disappear. Even Mr. Lennox's well-regulated professional voice took a softer, tenderer tone as he drew near to the extinction of the last hope. It was not that Margaret had not been perfectly aware of the result before. It was only that the details of each successive disappointment came with such relentless minuteness to quench all hope that she at last barely gave way to tears. Mr. Lennox stopped reading.
"I had better not go on," said he in a concerned voice. "It was a foolish proposal of mine. Lieutenant Hale,"
and even this giving him the title of the service from which he had so harshly been expelled, was soothing to Margaret. "Lieutenant Hale is happy now. more secure in fortune and future prospects than he could ever have been in the Navy, and has doubtless adopted his wife's country as his own.
That is it, said Margaret. It seems so selfish in me to regret it, trying to smile, and yet he is lost to me.